All right, good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, February 26, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everybody. We made it. Yay. A really long week this week. It is 20 degrees with light snow and a little bit of sunshine here in upstate New York. Got pretty cold last night. I think it got down to the teens, so doesn't feel like spring at this point. It was warm yesterday morning, but by the end of the day, it turned back into winter. So where do we leave off yesterday? We've been doing a week of robots and brains. Titled the show yesterday, DARPA, Vagus Nerve, Frozen Brains, and Uploading Yourself. And yeah, we did look at a story that was talking about the hopes to be able to upload our consciousness after death. And we're going to continue looking at the brain to kick it off and end it for Friday. I found a lot of disturbing information. Remember, this Global Brain Project, Obama had pointed out that the Brain Project was going to be the 21st century equivalent of what the Genomics Project did for the 20th century and 20th century medicine. And just don't forget that any time that they're talking about cracking the secrets of the brain is the thing that makes you what you are. You know, I've always told my kid, when you're out on the playground and stuff, you know, because kids do stupid things, I'm like, the one thing you want to make sure you protect more than anything else is your brain. Because if you injure your brain, you could no longer be you, and you may not ever come back again if you injure your brain. So you need to take very good care of your brain. Well, as we have now, you know, these companies coming out with these dopamine headphones. We talked about those yesterday as well. You know, put on a pair of headphones and get a high like you've never had before, is what the story said, from these dopamine headphones. You know, how is that going to change your chemical makeup of your brain? You know, we discussed yesterday the production of dopamine in the use of video games, you know, our smart devices, dopamine's role in addiction, cocaine, cigarettes, gambling, sex. You know, it's got all these different functions for the satisfaction seeking reward behavior. And it's exactly how they manipulate mice in a maze. Don't you see that? So as we start as brain scientists, neurologists, and all these other scientists from all across the gamut, wait until you take a look who's in charge here at this Nirvana, the company that's putting out these dopamine headsets. But, you know, as they start learning how to control these chemicals, and let's go back to all the DARPA research that we've been reading about for the last 2 years with their brain research. Right now, I don't remember. Subnuts, that was the name of the program. Search subnets, as in a computer subnets, but S-U-B-N-E-T-S in DARPA, and you can read all about it. But a lot of the research started there, of course, to be applied to soldiers in the battlefield, to be able to help soldiers overcome fear, where your commander could be sitting at command and control and be able to push a button for little Johnny, because he can sense, with Johnny's biosensors in his fighting suit, that Johnny's afraid. So let's give him a little bit more adrenaline and, I don't know, let's dose him with some dopamine and see if he's going to go after that insurgent without being afraid. All right, anyway, so we talked about these dopamine headphones and, you know, how dopamine can be used to manipulate in many different ways. Let's take a look at the founders and the team of this company that's putting out these headphones. The headphones that, in the story we read, they said that there's no information out there that the company put out about where this research happened or how this research happened. But we sure know that a lot of this research was done in DARPA's labs or whoever they subcontracted with to do this research. Well, check this out. So the co-founder of this dopamine headphone company, and by the way, these dopamine headphones are coming out next month. The co-founder is Dr. Richard Cartledge. Let's find out where Dr. Cartledge worked. Dr. Cartledge, he's smart. He's got a lot of degrees. Dr. Cartledge has 2 decades of experience in inventing, designing, and manufacturing cutting-edge medical devices. So this isn't some two-bit little company that's making these dopamine headphones. He is a founder of Smithson Cartledge Biomedical and inventor of Thermacore 1200, an FDA-approved rapid infusion and blood-warming device. The Thermacore 1200 was awarded 4 Department of Defense appropriations during the course of development. His device has saved countless lives worldwide. Dr. Cartledge is also a founder of Mitral Solutions, which developed the very first adjustable mitral valve annuloplasty ring. He has more than 80 issued and pending patents, and currently he's also the chief of cardiac surgery at Boca Raton Regional Hospital, is a cardiothoracic and vascular surgeon, a specialist in heart valve surgery, and a regional pioneer of minimally invasive heart valve surgeries. He performs on and off pump coronary bypass surgeries, complex mitral valve repair, thoracic aortic surgery, minimally invasive lung surgeries, as well as countless other innovative procedures. Dr. Cartledge is fellowship trained in cardiovascular surgery from New York Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Institute, and in thoracic surgical oncology from Memorial Sloan Kettering. It's like, Jesus, wait till you hear this. He received his medical degree from the Medical College of Pennsylvania, and he is a member of the Alpha Omega Alpha Medical Honor Society. And just to put the cherry on the top, he received a Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering at Lehigh University. So this is the co-founder of the Dopamine Headphone Company. Guys, are red bells going off for you? Do, 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 do. And his Thermacore 1200 invention won 4 Department of Defense appropriations contracts during the course of its development. So I see like sprinkle cash floating around there from DARPA. So we do hear now there's this other guy, Gregory L. Maybach. He's the other co-founder. Actually, there's 4 of them. Their CEO is a woman. Good, good, good for tax deductions. But Gregory L. Maybach is co-founder, and he has a double degree in electrical engineering and mathematics from Vanderbilt University's engineering school. And after, here we go, after working for government contractors on Star Wars, quote unquote, research in Huntsville, Alabama back in the 1980s. He was a Star Wars researcher, guys. After doing all that, Mr. Maybach attended law school at the University of Miami in his home state of Florida. And in addition to being one of the founding members of Nirvana, he has been a registered patent attorney for almost 20 years, during which time he procured over 1,500 patents in a variety of technology areas. Yeah, he's a great one to have on the team. Kermit Arthur Falk, who is the director of engineering. He has a bachelor degree of science and mechanical engineering from Georgia Tech and a master's of material science and engineering from where? Oh, the place with the biggest children's brain database in the United States. Good old John Hopkins University. Yay! He has a strong passion for engineering design and entrepreneurship. And prior to joining the Nirvana team, he worked in the nanotechnology field for a startup company near Tampa Bay, Florida. He also successfully completed an ARPA-E project, ding ding, that demonstrated membrane-based dehumidification and was subsequently awarded funding for a Department of Defense chiller project, which I do not know what a chiller project is, but it doesn't sound good, especially when this is the dude of the director of engineering for those Nirvana dopamine headphones. Mr. Falk has experience developing technologies at both the research and development as well as commercially available levels. So there you go, guys. I don't know. To me, it's pretty frightening that you have people like this that are making these DARPA-esque zapping brain chemical-inducing headphones. There's nothing out there that says, hey, look out, this could cause problems. You know, I was looking too. I'd asked whether or not you could have an OD on dopamine. And there are disorders out there of people whose brains require too much dopamine. One is called a psychopath. But number two, they had talked about, like, I mean, you can have these obsessions with all of these addictive behaviors that you can't control if you have these overdoses, and I'm trying to find it. I had the story yesterday of dopamine. I mean, here's the thing. Psychopaths have no empathy and will do anything that it takes to get what they want. They'll cheat and they'll steal and they'll screw their friends behind their backs as long as their friend doesn't know. And when the friend catches on, then they just use gaslighting to manipulate them and tell them how crazy they are because they weren't doing that. And then make it all your fault. And then everything's okay because they lull you back into complacency and hit that little dangling carrot to suck you back in. You know, these people are evil. And we are creating, I mean, we already had the whole issue of these last few generations who've never seen the world before digital, before video games. These kids are different than we were. We were born where our brains began development in an analog world. Okay, we didn't have 24/7 on demand instant gratification. 24/7, you had to wait for cartoons on Saturday. You know, remember that song that they used for Heinz ketchup? Anticipation. You know, anticipation is something that I think is very valuable as far as lessons go growing up, teaching you to be patient. And you know, the quote-unquote friends that I have that have this dopamine disorder, that's one thing that they don't have is patience. And not only do they don't have patience, but they can't go from point A to point B without completely screwing things up, you know, when it comes to a project, let's say, because it can't be patient. They have to click all the buttons and break it immediately. I will guarantee you as a kid, they were the ones that went to their friends' houses and broke all their toys and made a big mess and probably stole something too. But for those of us who grew up before the days of digital, where the beginnings of our young mind were developed before being programmed with lots and lots of flashes of light from many different regions and tones and sounds, teaching our brain to constantly want that Pavlovian dose of dopamine from whatever entertainment device you happen to be watching, I think that's why we have some immunity to it.
I mean, I definitely can feel the addiction and the draw. I could get sucked into the machine all day if I allow myself. Thank God my back and my ass doesn't allow me to. I need to get up and move around. But, you know, for those of our children who have been born into this world, who never knew the world before of VCR or on-demand DVR, the world before video games, the world before anything. For those children who grew up from 2 years old watching Sesame Street on PBS On Demand on their iPad in their face, those kids have been wired to react very well to the dopamine dangling carrot for the rat in the maze. They are controllable. You know, so then we can take them to the next step, get them playing those video games. 18 years old, they are ripe to go into the military. I just saw, there were a couple stories, but this morning there was one that came out about using video games, of course, to help brain injured soldiers rehabilitate. And, you know, they've been talking about doing that type of stuff for a long time. First-person shooter games could help mend damaged brains. And yeah, that's exactly what we want. We want to mend damaged brains by putting them into this dopamine alter reality world. It's disturbing. We started looking at also this blending of reality with fantasy, VR goggles, and uploading your consciousness after death. There were some researchers that had frozen the very first mammalian, I believe it was a rabbit brain, with antifreeze and was able to unfreeze it. And the brain was still perfect. And now they're saying they think they got it, Eureka. We can cryogenically freeze brains and preserve you for the future. Here's one out of TechSpot. New startup aims to transfer people's consciousnesses into artificial bodies so they can live forever. As advancements in technology continue at an ever-increasing pace, will there ever come a day when we will be able to use science to cheat death? I mean, what a pompous question that is. You know, that's what this all comes down to. All this technology that I talk about on this show pretty much has come down to being able to thwart death. Kurzweil with being able to cure aging as a disease. This is hubris to be gods and to live forever, to be all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful. It's lunacy. It's absolute lunacy. And as a species, I don't think that we've earned that privilege. We are not gods. And cheating death is going to cause us more harm than good, I believe. You know, they were talking, too, about the one story we read yesterday about uploading your brain, about how maybe in the future they can have, like, these big cloud storage repositories, and we'll be able to just upload your consciousness there, and there'll be all your friends and family and Nana and your parents all living in this artificially constructed quote-unquote heaven of some sorts in a server room of clustered servers creating a cloud. I mean, I don't know. Stay with me here for a second, because like heaven in the clouds, now we're talking cloud computing and uploading your consciousness into a cloud. Could, you know, think about if you had some super intelligent race there somewhere that genetically engineered us millions of years ago and dropped us here on this planet, or mixed up cells that they then allowed to form in some warm ocean and evolve into what we are today. If there is some sort of consciousness, and I mean, I don't know, whatever your religious beliefs are, I had my rocket scientist boyfriend in college actually believed that when you were dead, that's all you were, was dead. It was black. Black, and you're buried in the ground, and that was it. You didn't see, hear, feel anything. But I had a family member who had his aorta blown off when he was a teenager and died on the operating table about 20 times. He's paralyzed from the waist down for the rest of his life. But he told me some incredible stories of some whacked out stuff that he saw in all those times that he died. He saw the whole procedure going on from up above. You know, the same stories that you've heard on, you know, amazing death, near-death experiences on the History Channel or whatever. And, you know, there's question as to whether or not that is just some sort of programmed chemical reaction in the brain, or if consciousness really is some sort of physical, I don't, you wouldn't even call it an entity. I don't know what it is. It's the vapor. It's the ether. If there is some sort of consciousness or life force or something like that, that then can leave. And here's my personal opinion on all this. I've thought long and hard. I spent many years, I studied religions from all over the world when I was getting my English degree. So I find it very fascinating, that in archaeology and just what makes us tick and why we're here. And I came to the conclusion while I was working on a physics degree that I thought I was going to go get after an English degree. Didn't work out too well because physics professors at large universities are assholes and don't care whether or not you learn jack shit. But, by the way, just for the record here, I thought this was pretty awesome. And you know what? If I don't have it handy, I shared it somewhere. I don't know where I shared it. Oh, maybe I subbed her. I'll put it in the notes, but if anyone's interested in physics, one of the girls I'm a Facebook friend with, I met her through, I think it was Libby Haleve, and the Fukushima stuff, ends up, she is a physics teacher and has put her entire courseware online. I think she's a high school physics teacher, but put her entire courseware online, has recorded all of her classes, and now she's put them out as a free entire course on physics, and has found all kinds of research at all the different universities and is linked to all the stuff. So I think I might actually be doing some of that in my not so spare time. But physics is the science that explains what makes everything in the world tick. That's why I'm so interested in it. Even though some of it's pretty mind-bending, it's all those natural laws that we just take for granted. But there's actually mathematics to it, and it's pretty interesting when you think about that. But here's the thing. One of the main laws of physics was matter is never created or ever destroyed. It just changes form. And when I started thinking about whether or not there's an essence that escapes from our being when we pass, who's to say? I mean, if you take a look at something, and I'm getting way off the track here, I'm kind of getting metaphysical, but it's Friday, so who cares? But if you take a look at sublimation, you know, just look at water, and we are mostly water. That's why I always go back to water as being something important. And water is a substance that's different than any other substance, by the way. I was reading about that not too long ago. Water is very unique, and it does some strange things. But, you know, you can have water at one temperature be solid, and then as it warms up, it could be liquid. And then as it heats up, it becomes a gas. And just because water's become water vapor doesn't mean that it's no less water anymore. If you captured that water vapor as steam, you would be able to reconstitute that water, like if you were doing distillation, let's say, back into liquid again when it cooled back down. Well, I've discovered that a lot of things in the universe and in our bodies, and this is kind of where we're going to go next, all seem to work on vibration, waves, frequencies. We're analog, remember. We're analog devices. Don't go digital. See, they're going to make us lose all of this beauty of the analog world. Waveforms are beautiful. like even on paper, I loved when we were doing plotting of sines, cosines. One of my favorite things to do was to draw waveforms. I love drawing waveforms and all the different kinds of waveforms. And then you could use them for measurement. They're just very cool. But and there's a lot of physical processes. They're all working on different frequencies and working on vibrational theory. And, you know, even if you go back to, I don't remember his first name. He's a physicist, last name Green. It's out of one of the New York universities. I actually watched a really good documentary by him back probably 10 years ago on string theory. That's what string theory is all about. They actually think that the entire universe is a bunch of vibrating strings. And if you go back to ancient texts, you go back to like medieval texts where they always talked about the harmony of the spheres and the music. And now with, you know, I don't remember which orbiter it was. One of the orbiters came back and got the actual music, the notes, the sounds that are being generated off of Jupiter. It's really eerie sounding. Wait till you guys hear this one. A scientist is turning every element in the periodic table into music. Mechanical engineer Ace Jung Henry is figuring out the unique musical signatures of every element on the periodic table to give scientists a new way of analyzing their constantly shifting molecular structure, as well as science nerds like us a chance to actually hear how different arrangements of molecules and chemical bonds can behave. Now, you know, I've had a theory about music for about 30 years, okay, and just all the different things that, not music in general, but notes, waves, forms, sounds, how they can affect biology and your thoughts. And I mean, they now know that you can use tones to push buttons. We talked about that yesterday in the brain. Think about how interesting it'll be. Because I definitely think that all of us has our one resonant frequency that all of our systems in our body, when they work in unison, work in a harmony like an orchestra. Yes, I played violin for 8 years too in an orchestra. But when somebody's out of tune, it makes you wince and grind your teeth. But when everybody is in harmony, it's a beautiful thing. And I think that that's your body. And when your body gets out of whack, you start having that one or two bad notes in there. That means you're getting sick. I don't know. Just a theory of mine. But I've spent a lot of years digging into things and postulating. And I really think that the more and more now that we're having all these discoveries with this mad science gone mad, I really don't think I was too far off. Anyway, back to the story. My hope is that it'll be an interesting tool to teach the periodic table, but also to give people some notion about the idea that the entire universe is moving around and making noise, Henry told Jennifer Ouellette from Gizmodo. You just can't hear it. So why does every chemical element have a unique musical signature? Well, we all know that everything in the universe is made up of atoms and that these atoms are in constant states of motion. And depending on the speed at which these atoms are vibrating within the bonds between the larger molecules, you will get a solid, a liquid, a gas, or a plasma. Ding! This is exactly my theory. And I mean, I couldn't even believe this when I saw this yesterday. I'm like, oh my God, all this stuff that I had like deduced and picked apart for all these years. Like this is actually in a ScienceAlert.com article discussing real true facts that is not fantasy. These vibrations or waves determine the specific properties of an element, such as its density and thermal conductivity. So the better our understanding of how atoms are zipping around, the more we'll know about the capabilities of a particular element. How the energy of the interaction changes with respect to the distance between the molecules dictates a lot of physics, says Henry, who's putting together a catalog of musical signatures for elements at Georgia Tech. You know, let me just stop for 1 second, too. A couple other things. Remember, we had done a story back a few months ago already about the the musical instructor, the conductor, you know, he worked at a university. So he was a musical teacher at a university. And he went to work with the cancer department. And they worked for years trying every frequency from low to high and exposing cancer cells to those frequencies. And they found resonant frequencies that cause cancer cells to literally shatter. How incredible is that? Says, we have to slow down the vibrations of the atoms so you can hear them because they are too fast and at too high of a frequency. But you'll be able to hear the difference between something low on the periodic table and something like carbon that is very high. One sound will be high pitched and one sound will be low. The idea is based on the fact that in past studies, scientists have discovered key properties of elements by employing different senses. And the movements of the molecules within an element can sometimes be so subtle or so short-lived that you will never spot them just looking at the visual data. But a slight ping or a change in tone, however, could make all the difference. While it might sound like a fun little project, wait till you hear this. It's actually a time-tested technique that was used in a project at CERN, the good old Large Hadron Collider, called the LHC sound, to analyze the data from particle collisions, which allowed physicists to detect subatomic particles by ear. And Henry has even used it to identify new properties in polymers that didn't show up in computer models and simulations of atomic vibrations. Quote, the simulated polymer becomes thermally superconductive, that is, capable of transporting heat with no resistance, much like the existing class of superconducting materials that conduct electricity without resistance. Henry and graduate student Wee successfully identified three vibrational modes out of all those sounds that were responsible for the phenomenon, but the usual analysis techniques, like plotting, listen to this, like plotting amplitudes of the modes over time in a visual graph, did not reveal anything noteworthy. It wasn't until they decided to sonify the data, that's a pretty neat term, sonify the data, that they were pinpointed as to what was going on, and this involved mapping pitch, timbre, and amplitude onto the data to translate it into a kind of molecular music. Henry has published his sonification work in the Journal of Applied Physics and has applied for the National Science Foundation grant to turn his catalog into an app so we can not only hear the musical signatures, but we can also make our own. In the meantime, you can listen to the sound of crystalline silicon in the video below, and I will link this story in the notes of the show, and head over to the Gizmodo where you can hear the difference between divergent bonds, covalent bonds, and the two working together. There is a whole universe out there to explore, and this time we won't be needing our eyes. How damn cool is that? Like, I just literally almost fell off my chair when I found that story yesterday. But here's one that I talked about during the show yesterday. New evidence for the vibration theory of smell. Yeah, smell is a vibration too, as is light. Light is a wave and a particle. The predictive power and galvanizing influence that theoretical models routinely enjoy in physics is only rarely replicated in biology. Lord Rayleigh's theory of sound perception, Francis Crick's sequence and adapter hypotheses, and Hodgkin and Huxley's model of the electrical dynamics of neurons are just a few notable exceptions that have gone on to spawn entire scientific industries. Although it is hard to find comparable mechanistic drama unfolding in our current century, Luca Turin's vibrational theory of olfaction has been a persistently fertile seed that has now ripened into a contentious fruit. Oh, someone's been practicing with a thesaurus. And it's not me. One way to judge a theory is by how hard its detractors work to disembowel it. Hey, so when I come up with a theory and we get eviscerated by not only Discover Magazine, but Oxitec themselves, no, we're not on top of what do they call it, the target. Not at all. So we get eviscerated online. Last year, one group went so far as to express human and mouse olfactory receptors in an in vitro kidney cell prepared to see if durated synthetic musks with alterated vibrational signatures gave different responses. Who the hell knows what that means? I think it's they probably were doing like musky smells versus something else. That group, perhaps not surprisingly, didn't find a whole lot to support the vibration theory. But now, a study using live honeybees did. Oh. A group at the University of Trento, led by Elbrechas, was able to prove by direct imaging of the brain that the bee olfactory system can clearly distinguish odorants with different vibrational frequencies despite having identical shapes. And it gets very technical, and you know what? It's Friday. It makes my head hurt. So we're not going to read all the technicals on how they were shaping these different smells. But let's write the trick. Let's scroll down to the bottom and see where it ends. See how this story ends up. Wow, this is pretty crazy. It gets into RNA and everything. In applying hard limiters to classify the protein kits we find in cells, namely receptors, enzymes, and ion channels, we end up with quite a salad of their associated protagonists. Depending on how they act or excite, we give them names like ligand, prosthetic group, substrate, or even potential. The most versatile of our enzymes typically flex tiny, vitaminized nucleotide derivatives at their core. Many of these primordial coenzymes, in turn, nest a single metal ion knife edge that, by nature of its coordinated chemistry, originally had some inherent penchant for catalysts. I can't read this, guys. This is just, whoever this person is was trying to sound just too overly smart by whipping out some thesaurus app to make this flowery language. But basically what it comes down to is the title, New Evidence for the Vibration Theory of Smell. I mean, maybe the last paragraph will sum it all up. Explaining these two phenomena in terms of density fluctuation in a fluid mixture approaching its critical point, Einstein effectively solved the question of why the sky is blue to now solve the questions of why the fish is fishy and why the sugar is sweet. We await someone with an inordinate fondness for terpenoids to imagine sitting on a molecule of carvone. Did that make any sense at all? I really hope somebody bashed this author. It was a useless story. I mean, put it in. So we've talked about before about just the techno babble, and it's just too hard for these dumbed down brains that we've developed using dopamine and video games and instant gratification to distract, to understand. So if they just make it real difficult like that, people go, eh, and they just ignore and go on to something else. Anyway, so smell, sight, the periodic table are all about vibrations, strings, waves, and potentially music. We're analog, baby. All right, one more. Film coding. Talked about this yesterday, transforms contact lenses into computer screens coming to an eyeball near you. A polymer film coating with the ability to turn contact lenses into computer screens is set to transform the wearable visual aids into the next generation of ding ding consumer electronics. I told you it was coming, guys. This is your smart device in your eyeball, touching your optic nerve with a direct connect to your brain. Scientists from the University of South Australia's Future Industries Institute have successfully completed a proof of concept research on a polymer film coating that conducts electricity on a contact lens with the potential to build miniature electrical circuits that are safe to be worn by a person. Researcher and associate professor Drew Evans said the technology was a game changer and could provide one of the safest methods to bring people and their smart devices closer together. Can you see augmented cognition? Guys, the very next step is the brain implant. Don't do it. You know, and I know what they're going to promise you because we've already seen them, these infrared contact lenses. You're going to have infrared supervision, x-ray vision, always connected internet on your eyeball. Blink, blink, let's get the map to Nana's house. Quote, we're talking about anything from a simple sensor that can measure the amount of glucose in your blood. And remember, that was a Google project out of Google Life Sciences. They were already putting that into development. To actually creating electronic displays. So rather than having something like a pair of glasses, which they're talking about Google Glass, that's acting like a computer, you can actually generate images directly on your contact lens. We have always known that our film coding technologies had a potential for many applications, and now we have taken that a step further by proving that we can make biocompatible conducting polymers at a nanoscale and grow them directly on a contact lens. The University of South Australia polymer coding research is a game changer for high-tech contact lens industries. Sky is the limit, and we're working and doing with our industry partners to give them this game-changing technology, and obviously the time frame to go from where we are now to each of these different applications is unknown, but it's the first step forward to being able to do a lot of all of that. Guys, it is coming. Once everybody is wearing these internet-connected contact lenses, whether or not the prescription, I mean, we also were looking at one point whether or not they had photo gray contact lenses, and they have that too. So, zoom, you know what? It's too sunny out. There's too much UV radiation. It's going to be now required for eye health that we all have to wear these contact lenses. I don't know. I just see that coming. Eye health. Make sure you get, you know, connected. All right, here's one that came from possible suspect yesterday in a big cash. He found the money shot of brain research stories. Scientists discover that our brain waves can be sent by electrical fields. Oh, yes. Most biology students will be able to tell you that neural signals are sent via mechanisms such as synaptic transmission, gap junctions, and diffusion processes. But a new study suggests that there is another way that our brains transmit information from one place to another. Researchers in the U.S. have recorded neural spikes traveling too slowly in the brain to be explained by conventional signaling mechanisms. And in the absence of other plausible explanations, the scientists believe that these brain waves are being transmitted by a weak electrical field and that they are able to detect these in mice. Researchers have thought that the brain's endogenous electrical fields are too weak to propagate wave transmission, says Dominique Durand, a biomedical engineer at Case Western University. But it appears that the brain may be using these fields to communicate without synaptic transmissions, gap junctions, or diffusion. Running computer simulations to model their hypothesis, the researchers found that electrical fields can mediate propagation across layers of neurons, and while the field is of low amplitude, it's able to excite and activate its immediate neighbors, which subsequently activate more neurons traveling across the brain at about 10 centimeters per second. Testing it on mouse hippocampi, yes, the plural, produce similar results. And when the researchers applied a blocking field, it also slowed down the speed of the wave. So according to researchers, this is now evidence that the propagation mechanism for the activity is consistent with the electrical field. The results indicate that electrical fields are capable of mediating propagation of self-regenerating neural waves. This novel mechanism, coupled cell by volume conduction, could be involved in other types of propagating neural signals, such as slow wave sleep, sharp hippocampal waves, theta waves, or seizures. Their findings, which are reported in the Journal of Neuroscience, can be expounded in further studies, and it could help us better understand how brain waves are associated with things like memory, epilepsy, and healthy physiology. So look out. I mean, they are like cracking every single mystery of the brain, and it's not going to turn out good for you or me. There's another one out of Science Daily. I don't know. I guess just hitting all this brain stuff because it's really disturbing to me. Neurons in the brain tune in to different frequencies for different spatial memory tasks. So our brains even have different frequencies for different spatial tasks. I mean, we already know, if you look at some of the research that's been done with the different levels of consciousness, from being fully awake to being in your deep, I believe it's theta, sleep, your brain's at a different frequency, literally, when you're in your different states of consciousness. And there's four of them. There's alpha, beta, theta, and something else. Delta, I believe. Maybe delta is the low sleep. But we're analog, people. They're trying to make us digital. This is what we don't want to be digital. Remember sounds? Remember how amazing an amplifier sounds when it has tubes? Versus how amplifiers sound when they have boards and resistors. There was a warm sound, good old jukeboxes, that had big glowing tubes in them, versus jukeboxes that are playing MP3s. There is a huge difference. They're going to take that away from us. It's the connection to life. Analog is what makes everything in the universe work. Analog is one of the core tenets to existence. It's how we see and how we feel and how we hear. It's just really bothersome. They are trying to take that away and make us cold. Zero or one. You are either on or you are either off. There is no beautiful harmony or melding or blending of anything. It's a zero or a one. All right. Neurons and brain tune into different frequencies for different spatial memory tasks. Your brain transmits information about your current location and memories of past locations over the same neural pathways using different frequencies of a rhythmic electrical activity called gamma waves, report neuroscientists. And research may provide insight into the cognitive and memory disruptions seen as in diseases such as schizophrenia and Alzheimer's, in which your gamma waves are disturbed. Well, that's interesting. With this big outbreak of all these schizophrenia and Alzheimer's mental diseases, and they're blaming them all on plaques, this, that, and the other thing. Who knows? Maybe all of this electromagnetic radiation all over that we're being dosed with every second of the day, soon to be 5G cellular internet in the sky all over America, thanks to Google. Maybe, just maybe, some of that stuff is interfering with things such as our gamma waves in our brain. I don't know, just a theory. But you know, electromagnetic pollution is a big deal that they are just absolutely ignoring in the name of ubiquitous computing. Think how that's going to work when you put an internet contact lens in your eyeball and you got some 802.11 wireless transmitter right next to your eye or plugged in behind your ear. How's that going to work out right up next to the brain? Your brain transmits information about your current location and the memories of past locations over the same neural pathways using different frequencies of a rhythmic electrical activity called gamma waves, report neuroscientists at the University of Texas at Austin. The research published in the journal Neuron may provide insight into the cognitive and memory disruptions seen in diseases such as schizophrenia and Alzheimer's. Previous research has shown that the same brain region is activated whether we're storing memories of a new place or recalling memories of past places that we've been. Many of us leave our cars in a parking garage on a daily basis, and every morning we create a memory where we parked our car, which we retrieve in the evening when we pick it up, says Laura Colgan, assistant professor of neuroscience and a member of the Center for Learning and Memory in the University of Texas at Austin's College of Natural Sciences. How, then, do our brains distinguish between our current location and the memory of a location? Well, our new findings suggest a mechanism for distinguishing these different representations. Memory involving location is stored in an area of the brain called the hippocampus. Wow, the hippocampus is like where all the action happens. The neurons in the hippocampus that store spatial memories, such as where you parked your car, are called place cells. That same set of place cells are activated both when a new memory of a location is stored and later when the memory of that location is recalled or retrieved. And when the hippocampus forms a new spatial memory, it receives sensory information about your current location from a brain region called the entorhinal cortex. When the hippocampus recalls a past location, it retrieves the stored spatial memory from a subregion of the hippocampus. And again, this is now getting really technical. They talk about frequencies. The entorhinal cortex transmits these different types of information using different frequencies of gamma waves. The entorhinal cortex and gamma waves, I don't know, we'll have to look at waves one of these days. I dug deep into them last summer and was going to do a show on them, and then we never got to it. The entorhinal cortex uses fast gamma waves, which have a frequency of about 80 hertz. About the same frequency as a bass E note played on a piano. In contrast, the CA3, which is something that's in this part of the brain, sends its signals on slow gamma waves, which have a frequency of about 40 hertz. Colin and her colleagues hypothesized that fast gamma waves promote encoding of recent experiences, while slow gamma waves support memory retrieval. And these findings suggest that fast gamma waves promote current memory encoding. So this is messed up. So maybe you're just having electrical farts in your brain when you start getting Alzheimer's? Is that what they're saying? Because gamma waves are seen in so many areas of the brain besides the hippocampus, Colleen's findings may generalize beyond spatial memory. The ability for neurons to tune in to different frequencies of gamma waves provides a way for the brain to traffic different types of information across the same neural circuits. Wow. That's how we do wave division multiplexing in optics, in networking, where each of the different bandwidths of light are given a different frequency and then multiplex down the same piece of fiber optics. How crazy is that? Yes, we are, but machines. All right, I don't know. I have two more, and there's about 2 minutes, so I don't know if we're going to get through this. Researchers hack brainwaves to reveal pins and other personal data. Don't you dare ever think about your banking password when you slap on these new fancy brainwave headsets. Or at least that seems to be the lesson of a new study, which found that sensitive personal information, such as PIN numbers and credit card data, can be gleaned from brainwave data of users wearing a popular consumer-grade EEG headset. This is the IE, control the computer screen with your brain. A team of security researchers from Oxford, UC Berkeley, and the University of Geneva say that they were able to deduce digits of PIN numbers, birth months, areas of residence, and other personal information by presenting 30 headset-wearing subjects with the images of ATM machines, debit cards, maps, people, and random numbers in a series of experiments. The paper titled, quote, "On the Feasibility of Side-Channel Attacks with Brain-Computer Interfaces," represents the first major attempt to uncover potential security risks in the use of these headsets. The correct answer was found by the first guess in 20% of cases for the experiment with the PIN, the debit cards, people in the ATM machines, and the location was guessed exactly for 30% of users, the month of birth for 60% of users, and the bank based on the ATM machines for almost 30% as well. EEG headsets made by companies such as Emotive Systems and NeuroSky have become increasingly popular for gaming and other applications. The researchers, Ivanek Mirvak at Oxford University and blah, 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 say that it happens that these users, when they are presented with a stimulus, it occurs approximately 300 milliseconds after the event happens. In the case of EEG devices, this API provides unrestricted access to the raw EEG signal. Furthermore, such applications have complete control over the stimuli that can be presented to users. So don't worry about it, guys. There is brain spyware out there that's downloadable in the App Store, it says, and you could have hackers reading your brain waves if you use these devices. People, this is not a joke anymore. Science fiction is now, and if you can believe it, we are just plumb out of time, and it is the end of the week, 5 more days in the bag. So make sure you stick around because it is Friday. Ms. Lonnie Clark is up next with her Call-In Friday. Make sure someone calls in and has some good discussion. Lonnie loves phone calls. All right, guys, all kinds of great radio tonight. Josh Live at 6, 8 o'clock, Primer Time Boys Replay, 9, Truth on the Tracks, 10, Cutting Through the Matrix, and 11.